From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It is now day 24 of the partial federal government shutdown, and there appears to be no end in sight. Lawmakers are coming back to Washington for their first full week of legislative business since Democrats took control of the House. There are reports of airport security lines slowing to a crawl because of the shutdown. In Houston, a TSA security checkpoint actually closed on Sunday because of staffing issues. We know trash is overflowing at national parks and food inspections have slowed. And in Washington, D.C., effects of the shutdown can be felt almost everywhere you go. Joining us now is Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington, D.C. Mayor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And first of all, just ballpark for us, how many people in D.C. are affected by this shutdown, be they federal workers or contractors or whatever?
Well, we know we have more than 800,000 people nationwide, and we have over 100,000 in the D.C. metropolitan area. I think we're like 70,000 in D.C. proper.
These are just federal workers, but then, of course, there are contractors, too.
Of course.
Yeah. So what is it doing to D.C. right now, this shutdown?
Well, we know what the shutdown means, that critical government services aren't being offered. And we know when so many people don't know when they're going to get a paycheck, that it has immediate impacts on them, of course, and ripple effects on our whole economy. So people not working means they're not using Metro, they're not using rideshare, they're not using services. Our city, we're a city of 700,000 people. We swell to over 1 million people each workday, typically. And so we don't have the same level of activity that we would expect.
What kind of impacts are you seeing right now? You say that people aren't going to restaurants, they're not using Metro, et cetera. What more specifically are you seeing as a result of the shutdown?
We don't know, for example, what's going to happen with benefits that have been funded through the month of January, for sure, like food stamps or SNAP benefits. We're not sure. One of my directors just told me that he would begin to have some concern if this continues to proceed about Medicaid payments as well. So we're really in uncharted territory because this is the longest shutdown in the history of our nation.
Mm-hmm. What about the tourism industry there in D.C. with the museums closed right now?
That is a huge concern, Jeremy, because people have planned their trip. And we are watching closely kind of our hotel stays. I don't know that we've seen a hit to that yet, but we know a prolonged shutdown could affect people's travel decisions.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say to President Trump and to the Democrats about how to solve this problem?
The Democrats and Republicans have a responsibility to get the government open. And they all need to work to do that. That's in the House, that's in the Senate, and that's in the White House.
And do you think that as a Democrat yourself, that it would be worth it for you, for Democrats, to just give in to the demand for money for the border wall in order to reopen the government if that's what it takes?
I think that the two issues are separate. The government has to get open, and we need comprehensive immigration reform. I'm certainly not one that thinks that building a wall solves our immigration issues. I think that the president and the Congress also have to address the dreamers in our country. They have to address all of the people, and we are especially concerned about people in our city that are affected by the temporary protected status. So I would want a piecemeal approach to dealing with immigration reform, and I wouldn't want the government to be held hostage for that discussion, which is much lengthier. The government has to get open.
Mayor, just while we have you, I guess I can't have the mayor of Washington, D.C. on today without asking how you're doing with the snow removal, because this is an unusual event for you there.
We're doing great. I'm looking at our streets and I'm seeing blacktop all over the city, and we will be ready to open tomorrow.
That is Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks.
Well, let's turn now to the latest on the Russia investigation. Court documents are due to be released today in one of the trials of Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chair. Remember, other recent court filings revealed that Manafort shared polling data with a Russian with suspected ties to the Kremlin and Russian intelligence. And also today, the president denied that he ever worked on behalf of Russia. He was asked by Fox News this weekend because of reports that the FBI opened an investigation into whether he was a Russian agent after he fired then-FBI Director James Comey. This weekend, he didn't directly say he wasn't. Today, he did, speaking to reporters on the White House lawn.
I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question because it's the whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing has been tracking all of this. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
And remind us about these reports of an FBI investigation into the president. How is that different from what we already know, that the president's campaign was being investigated for possible collusion with the Russians?
Well, what it appears to confirm is that the implicit question that was part of that investigation that's been very public all along was also explicitly addressed internally by the FBI. The top officials at the Bureau in 2017 looked at themselves and said, if we're going to look into this Russian election interference in 2016 and whether it involved any Americans, we need to include the person who was at the top of this campaign. And so although that might have been an obvious inference for those of us on the outside, what the New York Times story establishes that, yes, the people in the FBI also thought that was necessary at the time. And that was part of the mandate that was given to the special counsel, Robert Mueller, when he was brought in after Comey was fired. What we don't know and what the New York Times story also was not able to establish was, has that investigation into that specific question continued today, or have the feds satisfied for themselves that, in fact, they don't need to pursue it?
Yeah.
Right now, we just don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. Well, what about this weekend's reports in the Washington Post that President Trump tried to hide details of conversations he had with Vladimir Putin, destroying notes from interpreters, for instance?
That's right. That was a very interesting development about something that we haven't heard a lot about since last summer when it was a very big deal. I know you remember President Trump went to Helsinki, the capital of Finland, and he had a big summit with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. And they had a meeting that took place behind the scenes for a long time with no one else present, no government officials, just an interpreter so the two men could talk because Trump doesn't speak Russian. Putin doesn't speak English that well, from what we understand. And no one knows on the American side, or very few people know, specifically what was discussed. And according to that Post story from Saturday, not only do people not know, the president instructed the interpreter who was present not to tell anyone else what was said. And if she took some notes or she had some materials that helped her with that interpreting process, the president took them from her, again, according to this Post story. The Post story also put that into the context of other actions that it said the president has taken inside the administration behind the scenes, some of which were public and some of which we learned about in the story, to try and minimize as much as he could, again, according to the Washington Post, people learning about the substance of his conversations with the Russian leader. The most famous example that had been public were the multiple explanations given by the White House and the president for the meeting in June of 2016 at which his top campaign deputies met a Russian delegation in New York City after it had been promised dirt on Hillary Clinton, their opponent. But there have been other examples of that as well. And so in this frame about what the president's relationship is with Russia and with the Russian president, that was very suggestive, especially coming so close on the heels of that New York Times story on Friday.
Well, Democrats have now renewed their calls to get testimony from an interpreter at one of those talks. How's that playing out?
It's playing out with a little bit of a different effect because when this came up before in the summer of last year, Democrats were in the minority in the House and the Senate. But since then, we've had the 2018 elections. Democrats have since taken a majority in the House, and they have the ability to convene hearings into whatever they want to talk about. And they also have the ability to compel materials from cabinet agencies and to ask witnesses under subpoena to come forward and talk with them. And so to the degree that that Time story and that Post story have reawakened these specific interests in the Helsinki meeting, the interpreter, her notes, and the conduct of the intelligence community in the State Department, Democrats are now in a different position to be able to pursue that. Elliot Engel, who's the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was on NPR over the weekend. He said he wants to do an investigation about that. Congressman Adam Schiff of California, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, he wants to talk about that as well. What we don't know is what level of energy the Democrats are willing to put into this. Will they try and issue a subpoena to compel tell whatever they can get from the State Department, or will they try to escalate their inquiries up from just speaking publicly to sending letters or taking other measures?
We'll be speaking more to Elliot Engel today. But meanwhile, continuing to set the table for the week, the president's pick to lead the Justice Department, William Barr, has confirmation hearings tomorrow. He's been an outspoken advocate of executive power. What are you expecting from those hearings?
Well, the Justice Department actually released the written testimony that Mr. Barr is going to give to the Judiciary Committee tomorrow, this morning. So we had a little sneak preview. He said he intends to let the special counsel's office do its work to completion. He said he favors transparency for whatever the results of that work are. If there's a report or if there's something else that Barr believes it should be public, it should be given to Congress. And also that he was just relying on public information when he criticized the special counsel investigation in a memo last summer. He said he didn't have any special insight into whether Mueller's office might be breaking the law or overstepping its bounds. And as Attorney General, he says he'll respect the independence of the office and let its work go ahead.
We'll see. NPR and National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
There have been five police suicides in Chicago in the last 6 months. And the Washington Post reports that all told, 140 law enforcement officers killed themselves in the last year, up from 108 the previous. That's more than all police on-duty deaths, including car accidents and heart attacks. Our next guest says that while there's been important spotlights on questionable police shootings of unarmed black men, maybe overlooked is how many officers are shooting themselves. Dave Corris is a retired commander in St. Paul, Minnesota. His son Jeff is a patrolman there who sought help after he shot an armed man. Dave's friend George's son did not get help. Dave and George Connolly served in the military together. George's son, Tom, became an officer in Lincoln County, Wisconsin. Seeing so many gruesome deaths, hit cyclists, overdoses, his colleagues called him Fatal Tom. Then he shot an armed, disturbed man, and soon Tom killed himself. Dave Corris, again the retired commander, gave Tom's eulogy. He says there's much we can learn from his friend's son and his own. Dave, welcome.
Thank you.
Had you ever been involved in a fatal shooting?
I have never fired my weapon at somebody and caused them to die. I've been in a lot of critical incidents, though. I mean, I was on a SWAT team and people shooting at us. And so a lot of times when people, they ask that dirty question, have you ever killed anybody? And my answer is I can think of the dozens of people that I didn't have to that I might have.
Yeah. The fact that you hadn't, was there suddenly a schism between you and your son? Is there something so deep about that people who aren't in that horrible club can't identify with them on that?
Well, like a gentleman on a sunny day on Snelling Avenue decided to try to take on the entire SWAT team, and I'm the one that's trying to assist him. We end up getting involved in the shooting, and I'm the one doing first aid on him. So I didn't pull the triggers. So a friend of mine did that. Him and I are separated by that because he did and I didn't. But when it comes to my son, he walks the same streets I walked for decades. And we had always talked about this, having a real high skill set so they could defend themselves and others and to be able to be that brave person who can step into that arena that nobody else will go to. And there's a vast majority of police officers that won't go there. They're afraid they'll take their time getting somewhere. Those true warriors or those true sheepdogs that are out there are the ones that resolve these very critical incidents. And I always wanted my son to be able to be that person, but I didn't want him to be involved in a deadly encounter. It was something I always prepared him for.
Well, in your son's case, over the radio came a message that shots were being fired. He raced to the scene and saw a woman on the ground bleeding. She'd already been shot by a man who reportedly replaced his schizophrenia medication with methamphetamine.
Right.
Was firing a handgun at the officers.
Right.
And the officers at one point had to shoot him.
Right.
What happened to your son afterwards?
Well, I could tell immediately when I saw him, I knew what he was going through because about 144 chemicals dump in your body. I had the ability to immediately listen to the actual call, and I could hear everything that he went through. I could almost see it in my mind. I could probably feel the breeze in my face, but I'm not him.
Well, and he started drifting away. I mean, he stopped driving to work in his uniform. He tinted his car windows, and his jaw started to lock up. You took him to a police psychologist specializing in the use of eye movement desensitization and reprocessing to treat trauma.
Right.
What is that?
The individual who kind of wrote the book on this, his book is called How to Survive a Police Career. He's a friend of mine. His name is Dr. Dennis Conroy. And that's what he does, is he helps police officers take traumatic events and compartmentalize them. There's a struggle here between trying to help somebody and then actually taking their life. And that internal struggle had those physical symptoms with it. I knew that he needed to see somebody. He's my son. I love him more than anything else, and I wanted to make sure that he was okay. And my son said it worked.
You move the eye around. Eye movement desensitization and
reprocessing,
and it helps with the trauma, and it did help your son. And the most important word in that sentence is help. Your son got help. Talk about the Connolly family. Just a devastating story. Their son also in a fatal shooting, but so many other gruesome, traumatic incidents. Nobody really knew the trouble he was in, took his life.
You know, my son became involved in this critical incident, but Tom had been in several of them, and George would call me, and I would constantly warn him, make sure you get him help, make sure you talk to him, make sure you ask him deep questions. Don't just take, yeah, I'm okay for an answer. Make him prove it. And what my portion of the eulogy was is that when I got off the phone with George about his son killing himself, I immediately called my son, and I demanded him to tell me that he was okay. And I asked him a question, have you ever been suicidal? Have you ever thought about suicide? Have you ever thought about taking your own life? Because for police officers, it's very easy to take a gun that's on your hip and put it in your mouth. Mm. Not like most people where they have to try to find the parts and put it all back together.
Or even get
firearms.
A gun.
Yeah, well,
they don't have one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a very quick decision and is very final. There is no going back. You can't think about it twice.
What did your son say?
He said, I'm okay. And I said, prove it. And he just continued on. He says, no, truly, I am okay. I have thought about that, but I'm okay. Now, I also have a daughter who's a correctional officer in Wisconsin in a pretty nasty prison. And so I immediately called her, too. Just recently, they had one of their correctional officers get arrested for DWI, and he immediately comes back to the prison, pulls into the parking lot, kills himself.
Well, that's chilling. And I'm still back on holster to mouth, you know, how easy it is. The Connollys, again, asked you to give their son's eulogy. What else did you say?
What I told them is that the gift that Tom gave us is to understand that these things are secondary damage to the events that he was involved in. So it's not like it's an in-the-line-of-duty death where he was shot by a bank robber. It was more like he carries this weight around, and finally it came to a point where he couldn't handle it anymore, so he took his own life. So you have to look at that as that is the level of public service that he was willing to give his heart that deeply to a community, that it was so brutal for him that he took his own life. And what it gives us, and it gave that police department, is to say the word out loud. Say the word suicide.
Well, tell us more about what it is you want people to know. I mean, in Chicago, they're talking about getting more counselors, eliminating the requirement for officers to have a firearms owner's identification card in order to get a job, because a card can be revoked for mental health reasons, and they don't want somebody to feel that they can't talk about suicide for fear that if they get mental health, they'll have their firearms card revoked. What message do you want to get across?
Well, first of all, you have to make sure that you're prepared for this. So you mentally prepare yourself. Back in the old days, they actually talked about fantasizing. If this happens, what would I do? You also have to be able to either have somebody else help you manage, which I was able to help my son with. I mean, I've been trained in suicide prevention and talking people off of bridges for years. But the big thing is say the word. And that's what they did at that funeral service. They said the word. And what I challenged in that eulogy is that everybody here is responsible for everybody else. So turn at the person who's looking to your right and to your left and be prepared to ask the question. Because you'll hear family members or friends always say, I just knew something was up. I just knew something was up.
Yeah.
And nobody said anything because they're afraid to say the word. That's the first thing you have to do to somebody when they're standing on a bridge. Do you want to kill yourself? Do you want to commit suicide? And if they haven't made that mental transition yet, maybe you can talk them out of it.
What we're hearing is that it doesn't matter if, like your son, the officer is declared a hero. They might still have some of these same feelings we're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, after a critical incident I was in, and my son describes it in his incident, and I've had other officers describe it in their incident, is that when you walk down the street, you think everybody's looking at you. Whether you're a paramedic that's handled a really bad call or or a firefighter that's handled a jumper or the like, is that you have to be able to know that part of your job is managing you.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. And again, this is broader than police shootings. This is how often police have to pull people from car wrecks or try to save children who maybe who've had domestic abuse. It's seeing the stuff. Some officers have said one of the things that keeps them from getting any mental health help is they don't want their partner to be thinking that they can't lean on them anymore. They have to go out in the field together again, and they're afraid that their partner won't trust them.
And that's absolutely true. And I know, you know, I have a real high-speed firefighter paramedic who's my best friend. He describes it best when he says, we think we're bulletproof. Okay, we don't need insurance. I'm not going to go get a physical. I'm the guy that does the rescues. Nobody rescues me. The issue that we have to constantly talk in our industry is that you are the warrior. You are the sheepdog that's protecting a society from the bad guys that are out there. But when it's time for you to rest, make sure that we are helping you rest. You know, my really old lieutenant one time back in the old days said that there's one job in America that everybody thinks they can do, and that's be a policeman. Mm. I wouldn't have done that. He should have done this. Everybody gets to judge about what they would have done. And we have to support those individuals that are out there. I say that guardedly because there are individuals that not only make mistakes but do things that are very specifically wrong, and those individuals need to be held accountable for that. However, the individuals that are out there willing to put themselves on the line, their own mental health, those individuals are heroes, and they're heroes before the day they end up getting involved in a critical incident.
Well, and we have to pay attention to why police officers have a 69% higher rate of suicide than the general population, according to police studies at the University of Buffalo. That's too high. Dave Corris, a retired police commander from the St. Paul Police, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you very much. And I want to thank you for putting this out on the air so people will talk about it. There's a cousin to an uncle to somebody who's going to just ask the question. And when you ask the question right away, things start getting better. So thank you.
Yeah. The question again, how are you? Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And again, for help, there's, of course, a national suicide hotline. New Jersey has Cop to Cop, a 24-hour hotline for first responders. And as Dave says, you have the person next to you. It's here now.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Democrats have taken full control of the government in Illinois today as J.B. Pritzker was sworn in as the state's 43rd governor. His party holds veto-proof majorities now in both the House and the Senate. In fact, Illinois Democrats haven't had majorities like this in the General Assembly since the 1960s. Pritzker, who comes from the family that owns the Hyatt Hotel chain, beat incumbent Republican Governor Bruce Rauner in a battle of billionaires in November. Rauner's tenure was marked by a stalemate with the legislature that left Illinois without a budget for more than 2 years. Joining us now is Sean Crawford, news director at WUIS in Springfield, the state capital. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Pritzker made some bold promises during the campaign, including raising the minimum wage, legalizing recreational marijuana and sports betting. Is he going to be able to get those things done now that his party controls everything?
Well, it is a progressive agenda that he's laid out, and to be honest, it's a pretty progressive General Assembly right now. A lot of Democrats, as you mentioned, have been, and a lot of new Democrats have been elected. So the theory is, yes, at least on some of these things, especially things that don't cost a lot of money to the state treasury, he could probably get some of these things through. Marijuana seems to be one of those real possibilities here in this session.
Is he going to need Republicans at all to get his agenda through?
he might need them on certain things, but it's such a huge Democratic majority. And again, some of these things, I think, are in lockstep with what the caucuses, the Democratic caucuses in the Illinois House and Senate want, that I don't know that he'll need them. He may want them. He may want to try to foster more bipartisanship for certain areas, but he can get through even if he can get a lot of these things through, even if a lot of Democrats decide they don't want to go along.
Illinois faces some major challenges. The state has more than $7 billion in unpaid bills. Pritzker is going to be trying to negotiate a new contract with the state's largest employee union, which was at an impasse with Governor Rauner. Talk about the challenges that Governor Pritzker faces.
Well, that's one right there, I think, in the sense that, you know, the state of Illinois has a huge backlog of bills, a lot of that brought on by a previous mismanagement of government through the years, and also because of that state budget impasse. When Bruce Rauner took over, he did not go ahead and put in place a higher income tax rate that had been there. It expired. He did not go along with that. And it took 2 years before lawmakers were able to put it back in. During that period of time, the state continued to spend at a higher rate like the tax was in place. And so the backlog of bills is up. There is a deficit in the current budget that he will inherit, that Pritzker will inherit here. And then we have one of the most unfunded pension liabilities in the U.S. So anything he does here, whether it comes to working with the state's unions, whether it comes to spending money on certain projects that he wants to get in place and policies, he's going to have to watch the bottom line.
And the state is dealing with population loss as well. That's been an issue for many years.
We are one of the most largest amounts of out-migration in the country, and that has not gotten better. That has been going on, like you said, for a number of years. So you have to be careful if you're going to increase taxes and do some of these things that can make it more difficult for people to stay in Illinois when you're already losing population.
Although I guess in this case, he's a billionaire, so he's going to maybe be able to say, it's not going to drive the rich people away if I raise taxes on them. Trust me, I'm one of them. But we'll see what happens there. And Sean, I guess we're also going to have to see if he's able to end up not leaving office and heading to prison like so many of his predecessors.
That's correct.
In Illinois.
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. Sean Crawford, news director at WUIS in Springfield, Illinois. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elle Simone calls herself the culinary Oprah, and in many ways she is, inspiring women to follow her example. A Detroit native, Elle Simone spent 7 years as a social worker before breaking barriers in the culinary industry, first as a food stylist, then a chef caterer, now as one of the hosts of PBS's iconic America's Test Kitchen, watched by 10 million viewers a month.
Hey, guys. Welcome back to Live Q&A. I'm Elle Simone, and this is my favorite person, Jack Bishop. And we're giving you our biweekly series where you get a chance to ask test cooks in our kitchen all of your interesting food questions.
She also founded She Chef, the country's only professional organization for the advancement and advocacy of women in the food industry, as chefs, caterers, entrepreneurs, restaurateurs, with a special focus on women of color like her, trying to make it in what's been a man's world. She joins us in the studio. Elle Simone, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Boy, America's Test Kitchen. When you first, I understand you came to audition for it and thought, well, maybe it's just some little, you know, sidebar thing.
Yes.
No, you're one of the hosts. What kind of a landmark was that for you?
Well, I certainly did not see myself in television in front of the camera. You know, I've always worked behind the camera. I always enjoy producing shows and creating content for people. So one would think that it was a natural transition, but it was very difficult.
The people from America's Test Kitchen were very clear. What you were bringing to them was something they felt they were missing. What do you think that was?
Well, I mean, I definitely feel like, you know, diversity is a very important movement, not just in the industry right now, but just, you know, in terms of representation. Like, people want their organizations to represent the world, you know, their viewers. And I feel that America's Test Kitchen was no different. You know, they cook a lot of amazing foods. They talk about a lot of, you know, wonderful regions in this country. And I think that they were just very interested in having their brand actually represent this country.
Right. And you heard from people, right? What were people, viewers, saying to you?
I've had mixed reactions. There are some people who are very excited, you know, to see not just a woman of color, but also just to see our organization moving in the direction of being more diverse. There are some people who are like, you're a token Black, you know.
Oh, and seriously?
Yeah. There are people who, you know, who feel some kind of way about it. I never felt that way. I personally don't feel that any movement that I make that advances women of color, people of color, I feel like that's a privilege. It's not something to fill a quota. It's a life's work.
Well, let me reinforce again, from what the producers of the show are saying, they didn't see it as tokenism at all. They actually saw it as not just enabling viewers to, as I hear they have, say, oh my gosh, someone who looks like me, finally.
Yes.
But there is food that I'm understanding that you talk about, bring to the table, literally, that represent more of the African-American culture.
Absolutely true. I've been able to do conversations about Edna Lewis and her recipe, the chicken and pastry.
Fabulous chef and cookbook.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Everyone should have an Edna Lewis book. You know, and just also just talking about my Midwestern perspective. You know, my grandparents came over in the Great Migration, and with them, they brought all their Southern-inspired recipes. So I bring all of those components to the table.
Talk about that, because that's how you got started. Your grandmother was a great cook.
My grandmother was a huge kitchen inspiration, and cooking with her really inspired my full interest towards food.
And you talk about her on your show. Let's listen.
We're going to use our hands and our palms to evenly distribute this crust.
My kind of cooking.
My grandmother was a hand cook. She
loved
putting her hands in food.
I hear that your grandmother's cornbread.
Her cornbread dressing.
Her cornbread dressing.
Yeah, her cornbread dressing was very, very popular. Mm. I think I make it well. I don't think I've ever discovered that secret ingredient that she probably didn't tell me and left for me to find myself, but it's pretty close.
And you're looking.
Yes, so, I am. I'm looking all the time.
For that secret ingredient. We mentioned that you were a social worker for 7 years.
Yeah.
But why? Did you not think that a cooking career was a possibility? What?
Honestly, no. I never thought of it as a serious career path. You know, At first, I never saw anyone who looked like me on any cooking show. I grew up in the Emerald era, you know, so first there were probably only men. At that time, I didn't come to know about Julia Childs until I was older, but I never saw anyone who looked like me. So I didn't think that that was a reality. And then, you know, my family always encouraged me to go into a more practical career path. And so I chose social work because, you know, I'm a sociologist. I love everything about people. Mm. So it was a natural fit.
Well, but first, food styling.
Yes.
Which is making food look good on camera, which is hard because lights melt it.
Yes.
And all of that.
True.
And then the test kitchen. And along the way, a battle with ovarian cancer.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You have that behind you.
I do.
But we understand that's part of, you know, your dedication to, okay, if I get through this, pulling other women along with you in something called She Chef.
Yes.
What is that?
She Chef is a professional networking organization for women chefs of color and our allies. It was born from the experiences that I had working in the culinary industry in New York City, going in various kitchens and finding myself to either be one of few women, sometimes the only woman, definitely one of few women of color, if not the only woman of color. I was sure that there were other women who were having the same experience because I went to culinary school with lots of women of color, but I never saw them in the workplace. Mm. And after doing a lot of market research, I found all the varying reasons that women were either not staying in the industry or were finding themselves unfulfilled. And some of those reasons were like the rate of pay. Most women of color are carrying their family on their back, you know, and you can't do that with $12 an hour.
Well, you also can't do that with the hours.
No.
You can't be there to put the kids to bed if you're doing the most important shift, which is night.
That's right. It's difficult when you don't have a support system, and a lot of those women were the support system for the family, you know.
Well, so you've got She Chef with 200 now paid members.
Yes.
in different cities. How do you help them?
I try to take some time and do a full assessment of them. You know, usually that includes like a phone conversation, looking over their resume, maybe talking to their references if they have them, and then pairing them with a mentor who is in their area of interest. Maybe they want to explore a new thing. I personally take on a lot of proteges who have previously worked in restaurant and who have an interest in food styling.
Mm-hmm.
I have members now who work at like Food 52, you know, because of this training and this connection.
Food 52?
Yes, Food 52 is a very popular online food publication. A lot of the greats, you know, come in and contribute to that publication.
We also understand you took a group of women on a field trip to see The Chew with Carla Hall.
Yes.
Who's one of the hosts who did the same kind of mentoring for you.
Yes, she did. And when I myself was freelancing at The Chew, Carla was obviously still one of the talent. I got paired with Carla a few times. We had synergy and I started working with her regularly. You know, she just taught me a lot. And it's so serendipitous because when I met her, I had absolutely no desire to be on television. And now that I'm in it, I can call or at least text her and say, hey, can I get your advice on this thing? She always takes my call. She always answers my emails. And, you know, she's really just been a support and inspiration.
And now you do this for others.
Yes.
Yeah, passing yes. on. Okay, well, do something for us right sure. now and for our listeners. Here you are with America's Test Kitchen. What are some tips, things that you've recently tested and discovered? What works, what doesn't?
I think more than what works and what doesn't, I think I've learned a lot of ways to just be more efficient in the kitchen, treating your home kitchen like you treat your restaurant kitchen and how you store things in your refrigerator. You know, you want to put meat and seafoods at the bottom. You want to put your produce in the proper drawers because they're the proper temperature, and just making sure you keep your fruits and vegetables up top so they don't get contaminated. Also, it seems like such a little thing, but a sharp knife keeps you from cutting yourself because it'll go straight through the food and won't wobble and hit your finger. And we also have some great videos about knife sharpening and knife care on Cooking School.
We'll link people up. One recent episode, baking soda can expire, so that container that I have in the refrigerator to take away odors that's 10 years old is probably not doing that anymore and surely cannot be used to bake.
No. Just checking expiration dates. A lot of people don't think that dry spices have expiration days, but they do. You should not keep your dry spices, you know, more than 90 days. You know, that's a stretch. So I always encourage people, just get small.
Tiny.
Tiny, yeah. You know.
That's Elle Simone, founder of She Chef and chef, food stylist, TV host at America's Test Kitchen. We'll link you up to everything at hearandnow.org. Elle, thank you so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
As the partial government shutdown drags on, the conversation in Washington is about whether or not to build a wall. But our next guest says we shouldn't be building a wall, but rather walls of houses, as the U.S. faces a housing shortage like it has never seen before. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
So set the scene for us, first of all. How bad is the housing shortage in this country, and why is it happening?
So we've heard a lot, and deservedly so, about America's last housing crisis, the housing crisis that led us into the Great Recession, that came out of too much debt and too much financial wizardry. Today's housing crisis is simpler. There just aren't enough homes. After the Great Recession, the adult population kept growing. Millennials entered their 20s, their 30s, but construction spending fell. So in 60 years of record keeping by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, home building per household has never been lower. We are in a construction recession still. And as a result, you have all these 20-somethings and 30-somethings who can't afford the homes that are available today. Home ownership among the millennial generation has actually plunged to a 60-year low. So you put it all together and you just don't have enough homes. And the scarcity of homes has led to an enormous growth in average home prices. Mm-hmm. And this is bad for the U.S. economy.
When you say construction recession. What are the reasons for that, and how much is it tied to the fact that the construction industry, as you point out, relies heavily on immigrant labor and there are fewer immigrants going into construction?
Exactly right. So first, you don't have enough homes. Second, there aren't enough construction workers. In part, that's because, as the Wall Street Journal and others have reported, native-born Americans, for a variety of reasons, don't seem as interested in becoming cement masons or carpenters anymore. And as a result, if native-born Americans aren't going to do the job of building houses, well, perhaps we should have immigrants do the job of building houses. Immigrants account for 25% of the construction labor force already, up to 40% of the construction labor force in states like New York and California. But we need to allow more immigrants to come in to do the work of building houses so that we can relieve the household affordability crisis. So right now we have a sort of we have all sorts of problems that are coming together. We have a scarcity of homes, a scarcity of construction workers, and on the demand side, too much student debt on the part of these millennials so they can't afford the homes that exist. There's a lot of problems here, but they need to be solved all at the same time, or else, a lot of these sort of warning lights that are going off about an upcoming recession, they could actually lead to that downturn that so many economists have foreseen.
There's one other thing that is probably figuring into this, which is the trade war and tariffs and the effect that it is having, that those tariffs are having on the cost of supplies, lumber and steel.
Right. If you want to make lumber or steel more affordable, the last thing you should be doing is trying to invoke a trade war against all of your trading partners. But even more serious than the trade war has been the immigration war. And as I said in this piece, the president, who has to be concerned about his 2020 reelection chances with all of these warning signs going off about an upcoming recession, he needs to be serious about making sure the economy is still growing into 2020. Well, if he's really concerned, he shouldn't be waging a war against immigrant labor. He should be finding a way to welcome more immigrants into this country in a legal way so that they can participate in a construction labor force which is seeing this shortage. It's really, really important, I think, to think systematically about all of this, because if you don't have as many homes, it hurts not just Trump voters, but all young voters, particularly those that increasingly are turning against the president.
Now, we have a federal department. Now, the government's shut down at the moment, but we have a federal department called the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And are the Trump administration's policies doing anything about this problem that you have pointed out?
No, they're doing close to nothing. It's remarkable the degree to which the Trump administration has actually suggested slashing HUD's funding, which would hurt the amount of affordable housing that's being built. The federal government has tools to fix this problem. I mean, yes, housing tends to be a local issue, but the federal government has tools. It can subsidize the construction of new affordable housing. It can subsidize low-income homeowners or low-income renters as well. But it's not doing enough. It's not doing enough to ensure that the construction industry and the housing industry, which is one of the most important motors of the U.S. economy, is running at full speed. And if we don't get it up to running at full speed, then it makes it more vulnerable to the kind of shocks that we're beginning to see.
Derek, when you zoom out and look at this problem historically, do you think that it's going to make sense that after the housing bubble burst a decade ago, that it was followed by a retreat, that we're in the opposite problem now?
I think historians looking at this moment in 20 years are going to say that America at this point was a land of extremes. It was a land of extremes if you look at the White House, the fact that we went from Obama to Trump. Mm-hmm. But it was also a land of extremes if you look at the housing sector, that we went from one of the most frothy go-go periods of construction in American history in the early 2000s to essentially a housing recession in the 2010s. We went from building too many homes, handing out too many loans, being too easy with housing policy, to suddenly constricting and hurting the economy by being too conservative. We need to find that right middle point, both in politics and in housing.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.